Advertising your business with GCN is simple, effective,
and more affordable than you might think.
Visit advertise.gcnlive.com for more info. Take your business to the next level.
Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
You know, the most adventurous thing we do in the Paracast is to find ways to communicate with Microsoft Skype. Now, you think Skype, you know, it's been around for 20 years or so. It should be easy. But trying to talk to Mark Olley today has proven to be a little troublesome. So he ended up calling us. Now, I don't want to say what he called us because this is terrestrial radio and we're not allowed to say those words, right, Mark?
Correct.
But seriously speaking, he called me, I called Tim, and I don't know what Tim called me back, but then that's it, seriously. No, we're going to have a really fascinating discussion about a book that Mark has written called The Polychronicon of Merlin, Joseph, and Arthur. And anything related to Merlin and King Arthur and all that stuff, everybody likes to hear about that. So we're going to kind of look at the facts and the fiction. First, I want to talk about, speaking of fiction, last week's episode. And some people say, you know what, in the days of the Paracast, the early days, you'd rag on people more than you do now. And I think the reason is we ran out of people to rag on. But we found a few more. Anyway, we were talking last week about a book from Ken Goodsword, who, by the way, was quite a good guest, called UFOs in the Bible. And I thought to myself, that's a pretty familiar title. Let me look it up. So the infamous M.K. Jessup, back in the 50s, wrote a book called UFO and the Bible, similar ground. Then there's a rather famous book called The Bible and Flying Saucers, Did a UFO Part the Red Sea?, written by Reverend Barry Downing. And that goes back quite a few years. And, of course, we have all the ancient astronaut books from Eric von Daniken, from people like Brinsley, Lepore, Trench, and lots of others. Okay, good to talk about that. Then we also had another guest who co-wrote a book with Ron called Before Roswell. And she is an interesting character. Tim, you were on Barbara DeLong's radio show a time or two, right?
Oh, yes, yeah. It's been a few years ago, but yeah.
Well, she was boasting about her superior ability to know when something was true or not. I guess I didn't say it then. I guess she thought of herself as a human lie detector. And then she ends up having this complete faith in the fake claims of such contactees as Billy Meyer and George Adamski. So I guess her lie detector failed when those two stories arose. I don't know.
Well, Billy Meyer's especially. I mean, it was proven a long time ago that his photographs were fakes. And obviously, you know, forced perspective of small models. But, you know, you'll find a lot of people, for whatever reason, still have a lot of faith in Billy Myers. I don't know why, you know. But then again, there are a lot of people out there in the public world that people have faith in that I'm wondering why they do, and I won't say names.
Well, with George Adamski, what surprises me is all the stuff that was resolved in the 50s. Comes back. Like a few weeks ago, somebody was mentioning the photos that George Adamski allegedly took of a flying saucer, that they couldn't be duplicated. This is after they were duplicated 55 years ago, rather credibly, in different ways. One using a Chrysler hubcap, the other using a surgical lamp. It was back to the 1950s. But people still have access to the Adamski books, and the exposés have died by the wayside. That's so unfortunate.
Well, I think that, you know, you have a lot of people that when it comes to the UFO phenomena, there are a lot of stories, especially Adamski and Billy Myers and others. Those are kind of the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, the first and the easiest for people to pick. I mean, I know for me, you know, I ran across as a kid George Adamski's second book. And you know, before I knew any better, you know, I was impressed by it. But, you know, if a person doesn't really do their research or their vetting of the subject and the people involved over the years, then, yeah, you know, you're going to keep that belief of some of these type of people. And you know, of course, I think that anybody who has been involved in the UFO field has a tendency to be suspect. I mean, there are people who still think that Bob Lazar, you know, really did what they did, and others. I don't know. It's I suppose it's like religion. It's a matter of faith.
Well, for example, I like Stanton Friedman. I knew him for like 40 years or so. Met him at conventions, interviewed him on the PowerCast. Until the end of his days, he believed or claimed to believe that the MJ-12 documents were really truthful. They were accurate. They were authentic. And that was pretty well known years ago that they were fakes in many ways.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes if he didn't put all of his eggs in that basket. And then later when more information about its, you know, non-validity of the MJ-12 papers, that he just didn't want to lose face, so to speak, and just, you know, stuck to his guns with it?
Well, I think sometimes you could sell that by saying, you know, things are going to change in this field, and things that we may have accepted as reality, maybe later on with more research we learn they're not real. And we have to be honest with ourselves and say, to understand what's happening in the flying saucer business, we have to do this. We have to revisit old cases. We have to hopefully solve them. And that gives us a mystery with more solid evidence. I don't know. Mark, have you followed much of this UFO lore that we're talking about?
Well, I was kind of hanging back a little bit. The next book, which I'm doing for Flying Disc Press, is on flying saucers, as the name might suggest. But going back to 2008, I did a documentary on a crashed UFO in this country, in Wales. The documentary went out as Europe's Roswell. And as a professional archaeologist, the thing that got my attention was the fact that they had pieces of it. So I've got a bit of it still here, and the main guy who did the recovery has a case full of these bits, which of course, you know, the old story goes, the MOD tried to get them back, etc., etc. And it was interesting listening to you guys sort of kicking the can about there, because we put the documentary out and we thought, hey, you know, woo, we've got it. Here we are. Here's pieces of a UFO. We can actually prove now that there's something up there flying around. It was met with complete silence. You know, nobody picked up on it. Nobody came forward and went, oh, can we test that? Can we have a look at that? Can we do this, that, and the other? Nobody. It was total and utter blanket blackout, which kind of goes to show, you know, the chase is better than the catch. They prefer the mystery. You know, the fiction and all that side of it is better than the reality. So I was just listening to you guys then. I mean, I was highly inspired by, you know, Flying Saucers Have Landed when I was a, you know, an extremely young teenager. My dad had it on his bookshelf, and I thought, oh yeah, this is interesting. I've had a few encounters with flying objects, and when we came to do the actual documentary, the way we approached it was, they are unidentified flying objects. You know, they're not necessarily alien, they're not necessarily full of little green men, they're things batting around up there that we don't know. You know, we just don't know what these things are. So listening to you guys then, it's interesting, because my next release, which is due out in August, is the book version of that DVD, and it takes a very sort of flat, pragmatic view of it. I mean, it amazes me, all these people have got all these books on the, you know, on the shelf about, you know, little green men and little flashes in the sky and things that they saw but they couldn't substantiate and all this, that, and the other.
We got more with Mark and Gene and Tim.
And a lot of laughter. You're in
the Paracast.
Hey, listeners. I want you to have the entire Paracast experience. So I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
If you have an IRA or 401k, please listen closely. My name is Jason Hansen. I'm a former CIA officer and New York Times bestselling author. Throughout my career, let's just say I've been in some hairy situations. And I believe right now the biggest threat facing Americans is they need to protect their wealth, which is exactly what I'm doing for my wife and six kids. And I believe the ultimate safe haven is physical gold and silver. You can protect your hard-earned retirement assets with a tax-free loophole that allows you to convert your retirement into physical gold and silver. The folks I use are Advantage Gold, and believe me, I've investigated the heck out of all types of people. Advantage Gold is the nation's highest rated gold company. They have the best process, pricing, and service. If you want to get your free gold and silver investment kit, please contact Advantage Gold right now, and you'll see how easy it is to protect yourself with precious metals. Call 800-900-8000. That's 800-900-8000. 800-900-8000.
Advantage Gold is not an investment advisor or a tax advisor. Consult with your financial advisor before investing.
Call 800-900-8000.
Frustrated trying to get business capital? Want to take the slow process and rejection out of the equation? GCNLoans.com removes the slow, irritating approval process. Instead, get quick, simple funding. Powered by David Allen Capital, 80% of our pre-qualified clients are approved in days. Pre-qualify at GCNLoans.com and get your money this week. It's that easy. GCNLoans.com. That's GCNLoans.com.
Hi, this is Sophie Winnick, longtime distributor and user of Longevity products. In the last few years, my family went through a crisis. Everything else in my life, including my business, had to be put on the back burner. Thankfully, life is getting back to normal now. But the one thing I never had to worry about was my business and my monthly commission. I've been a distributor for Longevity for over 17 years, since before it was Longevity. And I've got to say, the most amazing thing about this company is the people. While my family was in crisis, other distributors stepped in and helped my customers, simply because that's what Longevity people do, even for people they don't know. For me, it has never been about getting rich. It was about a product I could stand behind, a company I could count on, and a monthly commission check that has never, not once, been late in 17 years. Longevity is truly a business for everyone, even people who have too much to do. I'm Sophie Winnick. I'm just like you. I have a real life, real ups and downs, but I know I will always have Longevity.
Hi, I'm Dan Pilla. I started fighting the IRS over 40 years ago when they tried to seize my mother's house. I sued the IRS and won. I beat the IRS then, and I've been beating them ever since. I wrote the book on tax debt settlement, and I've helped thousands of people deal with tax problems they thought might never be solved. I can help you too. If you owe taxes you can't pay, don't wait another day. There's no such thing as a hopeless tax case. Call 800-34-NO-TAX or go to my website, danpilla.com. That's danpilla.com, danpilla.com.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
Mark Olley. The inimitable Mark Olley. And we were
thank you.
I'm very welcome. But we're basically talking about known hoaxes in the UFO field, and Mark is talking about what may be the Roswell of Wales and a book version of a documentary that he did. But let me cut to the chase here.
Yeah, please do.
Materials that you were handling, what were they made of?
The metal content, obviously it would have cost thousands of pounds to get every single like bit of it analysed when it came down in 1983. So the guys way back then managed to get as far as finding out what the metal was, and the metal turned out to be an alloy of duralumin, which in 1983 didn't exist, and this particular version of it shouldn't have existed. They knew in theory how to make it. It's in existence now, but then the other substances that were attached to this, the paint, the glue they used to sandwich some other foil onto it and various other bits and bobs in these pieces, I won't go into too much detail, but they couldn't analyse that. They couldn't find out. They could see elements, but they didn't know what it was. It was certainly advanced technology. Whether it was alien technology, well, the jury's still out.
There was a case in Brazil investigated by APRO back in the 50s where they recovered something with magnesium, which is nothing special, except that the purity level was allegedly more than we could deliver at the time. Of course, top secret experimental stuff, you never know.
Mark's book that will be coming out about this case, it sounds extremely fascinating, and I can't wait to read it.
Well, I've got to chip in and say the whole idea of the book, when it comes out, it's not very big on words, but it's big on photographs. You know, people want to see this stuff. So, you know, when it does eventually appear, which, you know, we can do another show on that perhaps when it comes out, you'll be able to see it. You know, it's a show, don't tell. At the end of the day, you know, this is the evidence for something batting about up there. It's a fascinating story. It's funny because it's kind of a story that begins at the end. You know, we start off with all these bits and then we have to go and find out what they are and where they came from. So it's like a reverse, flying saucer encounter. You know, fascinating story anyway.
It reminds me almost of this book we were talking about last week, Before Roswell. It calls it The Secret History of UFOs and then gives us lists of sightings many of us have heard about. So I guess we were all in on the secret. But unusual for a book, instead of starting at the beginning and going to the end, it starts with the most recent cases and then goes to the older cases, chapter by chapter. I thought that was at least different.
Yeah, this new book I've done is very similar. Starts with the evidence and then goes back to where it came from, and then we try and push it back further than that if we can, with some success. I hope folks enjoy it when it comes out. I hope it doesn't get completely ignored like the DVD and the television release was.
We will try our best to ignore it, Mark, but I think we're going to end up doing a show on it. How's that work for you?
Well, yeah, if my publisher has anything to do with it, I think it's more than likely. So, yeah, just give us a shout when you're ready. You know I'm here.
Sure. Well, of course, Philip Mantle is always very eager to tell us what new books he has out, because he has so many different titles. I'm surprised at some of the books he gets from Kevin Randall. He's done a couple for him. He came out with a book by Calvin Parker, and, you know, one of the people involved in the Pascagoula, Mississippi episode. How he got that book, I don't know. He did tell us, but I can't think offhand, but it was a miracle. Speaking of miracles, the Polychronicon of Merlin, Joseph, and Arthur. Now, of the names of books, this is kind of unique. I mean, last week we had an author who wrote a book with a title we could not say in complete words on terrestrial radio. And you can guess what that term was, because a lot of it is found in the UFO field, but unfortunately too much, but we try to get past it. But Polychronicon.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lovely way of joining from where we were in the conversation to where we were going. What I was actually going to say was, Philip, bless him, I mean, he does UFOs, that's his thing, you know, so for him to publish something on King Arthur, you might think it's totally unrelated and a bit of a sidestep, but then it kind of dawned on me, you know, if you're willing to put the UFO data out there and you're willing to tell the stories that people have to say about UFOs, that's probably considerably weirder, less accessible, strange, you know, unusual than King Arthur. Arthur's been around, you know, so long it's probably quite tame. So maybe it's not so unusual that he decided to publish this. The name basically is really simple. Polychronicon just means a chronological history. It's a medieval term that was used when they were trying to gather Arthur material together in the 13th and 14th century. They created this thing, this Polychronicon, back then. Plus the fact, if you've got 300 books on Arthur coming out worldwide every year, you've got to come up with a name that grabs it, but nobody else is using. I think I saw Tim's light go on then.
You know, I want to ask you here, why are we so fascinated with some guy from the Middle Ages, to be blunt about it?
Right, okay. There's several reasons for that. The reason that it happened in the first place is that he was the last, you know, of that golden age, that old order. When you say Middle Ages, yeah, what you actually mean is what we used to know as the Dark Ages. It's actually early medieval is the modern term for it. So you're looking at the Romans are coming to an end, you know, Druids are coming to an end, you know, the old world's coming to an end, you know, it's all about to end. And the very last person really in the UK that embodies that is Arthur. So people tend to look back on that as a golden age, and then that's been going on for a long time. You know, that was 1,500 plus years ago, and each time he gets sort of dredged up again, he gets reinvented for a new time period, a new age. And there's an awful lot of stuff in there, you know, in producing this book. Some of it just is incredibly modern. The kind of the background, the gritty reality hasn't really changed over the years. Well, would you want me to say a bit more?
No, you can go on as long as you need. We'll interrupt you when it's time to do our habitual breaking thing here. But let me just ask you briefly, and we'll have to break very quickly.
Okay.
What are the things that people would be surprised about the real guy rather than the guy that we see in the movies and TV?
Oh, I can read this straight off the back of the book, because this will help you, okay? Merlin becomes one of an ancient line of Pythagorean scholars and political visionaries. Joseph of Arimathea, who, as you know, brought the Grail, is a religious dissident fleeing persecution of death and death to far-off foreign shores. And Arthur is a hardened, womanizing battle leader who loses his entire family and culture to war and eventually natural disaster. Well, you don't get much more modern and up-to-date than that, really.
Well, of course, we have Camelot, the musical. You think about that.
Well, if you start asking me questions about specifics, which I'm hoping you are going to, you'll understand why that is Hollywood nonsense or fabricated nonsense. I don't know how you would call it.
Hollywood is sometimes very good at fabricated nonsense, even when they present something as factual. Mark, Gene, and Tim, you're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
If you're concerned about the power grid and want to generate your own supply of off-grid electricity, this will be the most important message you'll hear this year. Here's why. We now have a small number of solar generators back in stock. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving backup power when you need it most. And unlike gas generators, solar generators run quietly, emit no dangerous fumes, and produce an endless supply of free electricity from the sun. Whether it's wildfires, dangerous weather, power grid issues, or just getting off the grid, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. Even better, all this week, radio listeners get over $700 in free off-the-grid bonuses, too. Go to MySolarBackup.com to learn more and check availability. That's MySolarBackup.com. Look for the free report, Crisis Cooling, how to make absolutely sure your meat, milk, and medicines stay safe and cool in any power outage. Yours free at MySolarBackup.com.
USA News Update. Former Vice President Mike Pence is troubled by the potential indictment of Donald Trump. On Saturday, Pence told reporters an indictment would be concerning, though he's confident Trump can take care of himself. Earlier, Trump used social media to claim he'll soon be arrested due to a probe into alleged hush money payments and told his supporters to protest. Paris police are clashing with protesters for the third night in a row after French President Macron raised the retirement age. Thousands of people are marching and chanting for his resignation after he pushed through the new law without a parliamentary vote. At least 13 people are dead after a 6.5 magnitude earthquake hit off the coast of Ecuador. It was felt in 13 provinces across the country and collapsed buildings. USA News, I'm Karen Sloan.
Do you ever get the feeling that the world is being held together with duct tape? Every day we're thrown some new meaningless drama in the fake news to distract us from the reality we're all about to face. Between the government trying to print their way out of debt, military conflicts, the disintegration of our most trusted institutions, and a looming food shortage, preparedness is no longer a choice. It's a necessity. You can trust My Patriot Supply. Our emergency food kits come packed with tasty meals, averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Get at least one kit for each person in your family. Self-reliance is the only alternative to government food lines. Time is running out. Become ungovernable. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and save on dozens of different emergency food kits while you can. These kits are in stock, ship fast, and arrive in unmarked boxes for your privacy. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com before the next crisis strikes. MyPatriotSupply.com.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do yourself a favor. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA.
This is me, the Merciless. You are listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio, exactly according to my plan.
Now, we know that the people in King Arthur's time didn't stop and sing every time they talked. They didn't give us songs. I mean, I like the musical in terms of the music from it and everything, but now we look at the facts here. What happened in the musical Camelot that did not happen in the real world?
I could start at the beginning. Camelot does actually exist, but there's been lots of suggested places for Camelot. But when you actually do the archaeological and historical research, you discover that at that particular point, there's only one candidate in the UK for Camelot, and that is a city, a Roman city called Chester. When you look at Chester, it's got the biggest Dark Age palace because it's a converted bathhouse. It's got the biggest Roman amphitheatre in Britain. It's 11 acres bigger than any other Roman fort ever built. And it's got this strange elliptical building which would have been known as Tablierum Rotundus, which is in fact the round floor or the round table. So there, just in Camelot alone, is the reality that is behind the fiction. And clearly doesn't exactly match the fiction, so that raises a lot of questions. And of course, in the musical, Excalibur is in fact a Welsh sword called Caldebolg, made of bronze, and it's a flashing sword that was pulled from a stone mould, not from a stone in a churchyard. That's romanticism. Arthur couldn't have actually used it ceremonially, couldn't have used it to fight, because he was up against iron swords at this point, which would have just cut through it. So he's known to have had at least two other swords, one of which ended up in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre during the Crusades. So if these little monks out there have got this rusting iron bar in a cupboard somewhere and they've no idea what it is, chances are it was this sword that was sent in by Richard the Lionheart in medieval times. Guinevere is a Pictish queen. You know, she was married for military gain because he needed the sort of the extra warriors. Sir Gawain, who's his older cousin, becomes his main warrior leader, his main battle leader for campaigns. In actual fact, Lancelot doesn't really exist. He's a composite medieval character. There is a guy with an unpronounceable Welsh name that they think he originates from, but he doesn't really exist in that sense. And Arthur, as I said, he's a hardened battle leader. You know, he's a typical Dark Age chieftain. He was never a king. He was acting under probably Melgwyn of Gwynedd, who was the regional king at the time. He was just a really, really heroic warrior. I mean, when the Vikings, the Danes, and later the Normans got hold of him, they kind of glorified him almost out of all proportion. And Merlin, well, you know, Merlin would have appeared magical because of his knowledge and his experience and his wisdom and his abilities. And he wasn't the only one. Out of a list of druids, all with the title Merlin, he's about the third one. He's the third one in the list, and there's actually about six or seven of them over a 200-year period. But again, they were wiped out by the Saxons, so he's the last proper real druid. Arthur dies, and then Krakatoa erupts, which is this volcano, and the fallout from that drops all over the place in 542 AD, and they have 3 years of nuclear winter, and everything kind of comes to an end for a while. Hence, they forgot where he was buried, so you've got this legend that he's coming back. And if you go all the way back to Joseph of Arimathea, which, of course, is in the time Christ, so you're 500 years before Arthur, there's a lot of debate over exactly what the Holy Grail is, where it comes from, and you've got a real choice there, because it can either originate with the Last Supper, or it can originate with the crucifixion. So I do deal with that in quite a lot of detail in the book.
You don't ask Harrison Ford where the Grail is. By the way, some interesting facts here about Camelot. In 1960, it was a Broadway play where King Arthur was played by Richard Burton, Guinevere, Julie Andrews, Sir Lancelot, Robert Goulet. But in the movie version 1967, King Arthur was played by Richard Harris. And even stranger, that same year, Richard Harris had a hit record, MacArthur Park.
Wow.
Talk about trivia. Go on, please. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
By sheer coincidence, I'm also in a band. I'm in a band called Copperworm, and we've got our first album coming out soon. So I, too, am a musical archaeologist who has an interest in King Arthur. but it seems to follow Arthur around that. You know, I think bards traditionally have always sung his praises down the years. That's probably how we've got the bit of material surviving that we have. Bards, troubadours, storytellers, etc. So it's not actually, I suppose there is a little bit of credibility in producing a musical. It's following a long tradition of methods of communication of the legends of Arthur, which is worth me chucking in, by the way, that at the beginning, if you were telling stories about Arthur, you had to make them credible. So even though they've altered a lot of the details and they messed with it and exaggerated it and changed the geography and what have you, the basic core stories of the very, very early tales are consistent. They have to remain the same, otherwise nobody would accept them. Nobody would believe them. But once you get past sort of the invention of printing, you know, you get into that stage in the 14, 1500s, everything goes bonkers. You know, it becomes fantasy and free-for-all, so you've just got to be very careful. The book itself only uses the oldest surviving source for every subject and everything that's published. You go right back to the beginning. So some of it goes back before Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain. It goes back a long way. So if you really do want the gritty, you know, this is what we have left in terms of the truth, dash out and buy the book. There you go.
Well, your description almost sounds like an adventure movie. You know, you have the warrior, you know, the warrior hero king, you know, the magician, the love interest, the protagonist, antagonist, and then a volcano blows.
Yeah,
and messes it all up.
What can I say? I mean, to be honest with you, I've found this a lot. I mean, I did a book on Robin Hood, and I've done a lot of other biblical stuff and all kinds of stuff. I've looked at loads of subjects. I can categorically say that as a rule, the reality is better than the fiction, you know, by 100 million miles. You know, when you get into, like, you know, Mordred, Arthur's son, you know, ends up being, you know, the jilted son of Arthur's first lover, because Arthur in the original tradition had three wives. Well, he puts the first wife away and he puts Mordred away. So when you start getting into the twists and turns, you're into Game of Thrones territory here, you know what I mean? You're into serious, you know, in fighting, you know, amongst relatives and cousins and brothers and sons and fathers and, oh, honestly, I managed to disentangle that gladly in the book. I mean, don't be put off. It's not complex. But the reality is so much better. So much better. I keep waiting for an opportunity for you guys to jump in here.
Well, as far as the reality, I like to go into all these things here. Of course, we talk about Merlin as a magician. And depending on the particular interpretation, he can do all sorts of strange things. Like, for example, in the TV show Stargate SG-1, he's an ascended super being. Okay?
What?
That's what he is. What was he in reality?
Well, the first section of the book deals with Merlin. So what I'm dealing with is I'm going all the way back to the Bronze Age, and I'm dealing with a European Druidic tradition, which is basically what it is. I've got to say, very, very little survives of that. But what does, the Romans say that the Druids followed Pythagoras, so they follow the Greeks, and there's a huge amount of evidence of links between Druidism and the Greeks. But the Romans also say, if you want to be the best, you know, the best Druid in the world, best Druid on planet Earth, you need to go to Britain. You need to come here to learn the art of Druidry. So obviously, you would expect it to be, you know, a world-class centre for Druidism. Those Druids tended to gravitate to the centre of the landmass. So that puts them actually pretty much on top of Chester, where Chester is, because the Romans did the same thing. When they came over here, boom, they stuck the city right in the middle. So that's roughly the area where the Druids would have been. And lo and behold, that's the area where Arthur is. He's up here in the same territory. It used to be known as the Old North. And that's where Merlin is. So you're thinking, hang on a minute, this is brilliant. This guy's sitting on the shoulders of giants. His religion at this point is possibly over 3,000 years old, you know, and he's got all that philosophy and all that stuff behind him. Astrology, herbalism, everything. He's an amazing guy. Of course he's going to look magical. You know, he can tell you when the next eclipse is. Vis-a-vis, he can switch the sun off if he wants to, or the moon. You know, I mean, this is an amazing guy. He's a healer. He knows so much. He's also the third one to hold the title Merlin.
Before we go on, we'll learn about Merlin and more about King Arthur and all those things with Mark and Gene and Tim. You're in
Hoover Pelicars.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNLive.com today.
Do you need a website? Well, you can get a great deal on hosting services with Namecheap's legendary coupon code. They're offering substantial hosting discounts on shared hosting, business hosting, VPS hosting, reseller hosting, and even dedicated servers. Namecheap is preferred by millions. It's backed by a money-back guarantee. Use the coupon code LEGENDARY to cash in on this special deal at Namecheap.com, Namecheap.com.
First came Attack of the Rockoids, and it was a critically acclaimed success. And now there's The Coming of the Protectors. A former military intelligence man is contacted by a space woman in a dream. A dream that turns out to be a nightmare, because evil forces on her distant planet are planning to conquer the Earth. This is gripping science fiction of the classic kind. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors. Find out more at Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids, Rockoids.com.
Complement your health with hemp-derived cannabinoid oil. We've always believed that the closer to Earth, the better it is for our bodies. Our hemp-derived cannabinoid oil is phytocannabinoid-rich, full-spectrum, and organically grown. Finally, hemp made easy, clean, and effective. GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203. That's right, we cut through the red tape. It's now available at GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203.
Silver has always been nature's very own antibiotic, and only one system allows you to generate an endless supply of natural silver solutions. SilverLungs.com. You'll find no wild claims or pseudoscience, just a lifetime of nano-sized pure silver solutions. The Silver Lungs generator allows you to make your own, so stop paying for silver solutions. The unique lung delivery system targets respiratory infections where other silver solutions simply cannot reach. See the Silver Lungs generator and lung delivery system at SilverLungs.com. That's SilverLungs.com.
My name is Don Wiskin, and at 42 years old, I suffered a massive heart attack, lost 35% of my heart to damaged tissue, and was supposed to spend the rest of my life on disability. What did I do? I took Extendivite, a garlic and cayenne mix of seven herbs which rebuilt my heart and gave me back my life. For over 17 years now, I have made this formula available to you so you don't have to suffer the same thing I did. Clean your blocked arteries and strengthen your heart and boost your natural immune system. I'm 60 years old now, and I still work every day. To get your Extendivite, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822, or visit heartdrop.com. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
You don't sit behind a desk every day to earn a living. You're out and about making it happen. And sometimes you get a little bit behind on your paperwork, you know, like bookkeeping and paying your taxes. It's easy to get behind on paying your taxes. It happens to the best of us. And you know what happens next. The big bad IRS comes knocking on your door. And when that happens, you need to call the good old boys at the Tax Doctor. Let them do what they do best. Deal and negotiate with the IRS so you pay the lowest you can in back taxes that the law allows. We are a 100% U.S.-based company, and we've saved our clients millions over the years in back taxes. If you owe $10,000 or more in back taxes, call my friends right now at the Tax Doctor and learn more.
800-507-3137. 800-507-3137. 800-507-3137. That's 800-507-3137.
This is Micah Hanks of the Grayling Report, and you're listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
Now, let's just stop there, Mark Olley. There were three Merlins. Is this kind of like the super character, the Phantom, where it goes from father to son? The father dies and the son becomes the Phantom.
It's a bit like that, but it's a bit stranger. I mean, as you would expect, you know, nothing's ever straightforward in Dark Age Britain. The first one is Merlin Taliesin. Well, Taliesin's a poet, basically, and he's around in the early 400s, so he's before Merlin's born. The second one to have Merlin is Merlin Ambrosius. Now, Ambrosius is extremely clever, very clever regional ruler, and he's a military leader. He's actually the elder brother of Uther Pendragon, who is Arthur's father. So he has the title Merlin Ambrosius. Next one in line is the guy that we're actually talking about. That's a guy called Merlin Lelogan, which is, Lelogan means dear friend or little friend. And he's there right up to halfway through Arthur's time in office. And he's the guy that really pushes Arthur. You know, there's a possibility he lived to probably an age of about 102, 103. And he dies around about the time of the Battle of Badon in the middle of the Arthur story. The next guy to come on the scene is Merlin Willett, Merlin the Mad. Now, he sees the decline of Arthur, and he sees Arthur's defeat at Camlann by the hand of Mordred. So he's really not a happy chappy, and he finishes up going mad in the woods of Caledonia, which is southern Scotland, Cumbria, up that way. And then the very last one, Merlin Tatugan, nobody really knows much about him. He was a poet bard, but very little of him actually survives. We don't have anything really on record. And he survives right to the end of the 600s, but he gets wiped out by the Saxons, and the office ends with him. It's finito. There aren't any more after that. So I've got at least six of them. There were probably more, but that's the order of Merlins that ran in the territory of Arthur. Because I have tried to limit the book, you know. Otherwise, that'd be, you know, it'd be huge. It'd be like War and Peace or the Bible, or, you know, whatever. It'd be enormous. So I focus very much on that. But those are the ones I've got, and there's no relationship. There's no relationship biologically or in function or form in terms of their talents. They just seem to be spiritual, druidic, and prominent. You know, that seems to be the prerequisite for the title, Merlin. So it is a title. I'm not the first person to say it's a title. Somebody way, way back, I think in the 1500s, worked it out that there was at least three or four of them, and there's a lot of people that know that. I think I'm the first person to actually string them all together chronologically, hence Polychronicon, you know, and it makes sense. When you find out where these people are born and what kind of time period they live through, you start to get a window into their personality and how they think and how they feel. So you're right, actually. This book does read very much like a film script. You know, get somebody like Bruckheimer to get hold of this. It could be a classic.
Bruckheimer's getting kind of old there. You better hurry.
Yeah. What's the other one? Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott would probably nail this, actually, thinking about it.
Oh, yeah.
Ridley. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he'd be the man to do this. I don't know why he's never done an Arthur. Yeah, I don't think Scott or Bruckheimer have ever decided to tackle Arthur. So, you know, if they're listening to this and they want to give me a call, you know, you can hand my details over to them when they do.
I will do that for my usual price.
Of course. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. But you're looking at it here, Merlin, therefore, is not a name so much as a title. I am a Merlin, on the basis of what you're telling me here. You become a special person who does this, that, and the other thing. Any of these Merlins, other than probably being smart people, at least some of them, know anything that we'd call paranormal?
I would say that they are all aware of that, but to get inside the head of what they may or may not have known, you would have to study Celtic mythology, because their worldview would be a combination of Greek mythology, and that's then developed into Roman mythology, and because they're unique to the British Isles, you would then have to put in Celtic mythology. So the whole idea of there being a Celtic otherworld, coming from somewhere, living here, going to an afterlife, they would have had some belief in some form of afterlife. Spirits, ghosts, you know, the spirit of place, the spirit of the pools and the trees and the world that they lived in. They would have had a keen appreciation of that, but also from a scientific and a philosophical point of view, they would know how those things functioned, in ways that we've lost. You know, there is a genuine mystery there, where so much of what the Druids were was destroyed by people like the Romans and subsequent invaders. You know, there's a real mystery there. Yeah, definitely. But you've got to have a Celtic perspective, really, to see where they're coming from.
So I think most people are familiar with the legend of Arthur based on probably Victorian era tales. Those seem to be the ones that have the influence on the modern audience. But what's the oldest written record or poem that has been discovered about Arthur? You know, they go, you know, the furthest back, and you know, like, when was it written?
I think I'm correct in saying, because I'm doing this from memory, that it's a poem, and it's originated by language, we think, in southern Scotland. I think it gets quoted in the Black Book of Carmarthen, which is a Welsh book, which, from the writing style of the poem, you know that it's been written down in, say, the 9th or 10th century. So you can see it's really old. It's miles and miles before the Normans start writing stuff down in the 11th and 12th. You know, it's really early in the way it's been written down. But, and this is the kicker, when you start to look at the language, you actually, you know, try and decide what it is they're writing down. This socking great big long poem is all about a warrior, and it appears to go back to perhaps just after 600 AD. Mm. So now you're getting really close. You're within, you know, 60, 70, 80 years, maybe a lifetime or two lifetimes, of the death of Arthur. Now, this poem is long. I mean, it's a socking great big long thing, and it only mentions Arthur once. But boy, does it mention him, because it's verses and verses and verses about them singing the praises of this amazing warrior, this superb warrior that did this, that, and the other. And you get right to the very end of the poem, and the poem signs off by them, you know, by them singing the praises, and then this bottom line just says, "But he was no Arthur."
Hmm.
That's the punchline. So this guy's fabulous. This is a great warrior hero poem and all the rest of it, you know, in the style of Beowulf. He gets to the end of it, the last line just says, "But He was no Arthur. Now, what that very clearly says is that certainly within 100 years of Arthur dying, his reputation had started to break out of the confines of Wales. And it's not unusual that the first place that reputation would go is Scotland, southern Scotland, because basically that's the same race of Celtic Britons. There's a connection there with the Picts and the Scots, and that's where Guinevere's family came from, and this, that, and the other. So it's not unusual that it's that style of poem, and it's equally not unusual that it should then go all the way back to Wales and be actually written down by the Welsh bards, because that's where the interest in Arthur was. And then after that, it starts to tumble after that. There are more and more references, till eventually you get the famous battle list, which I think that probably got written down in the 10th century, probably. I think that's the source for that one. I can't remember all the books that they're in. I mean, honestly, my memory's good, but it's not that good. Most of the books are Welsh as well. You've got things like the Red Book of Hergest, the Black Book of Carmarthen. There's one in particular, though, which gives the first ever reference to Merlin, and it's the same one with the battle list in. So if you give me a second, I'm just trying to find it in my own book here. Do you know what? I did such a good job of this appendix at the end of this that it's almost impossible for me to find anything. There's so much in it. I'm looking at the pretty pictures here, hoping I stumble on it. I did find it. Basically, what we've got is the stuff that survived doesn't survive contemporary with the life of Arthur, but there's a lot of stuff that's you know, pretty jolly close. Here we go, the Annals of Wales, Annales Cambriae. It's compiled from the 8th century onwards, probably written at St. David's in Wales, about sort of 954 to 955 AD, with years subsequently added. And that mentions in 516 AD the Battle of Badon. That's in there. And I do believe it's got the first reference in there to Merlin as well. So if you really want to get stuck in, you want to see this starting to develop in a written form, then that's where things really start. So as the book quite ably proves, Geoffrey of Monmouth is not the first person to cover this material. It was already in circulation and fairly well covered by then. There's a lot of Saints' Lives as well, Welsh Lives of the Saints, where Arthur appears as a kind of a side character. So I've used a lot of stuff from the Saints' Lives as well.
More about the legend and the reality of King Arthur with Mark and Jean and Tim. You're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Hey, listeners. I want you to have the entire Paracast experience. So I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
I had no idea it would destroy my life, but before it happened, I had a successful business in Austin, Texas. Everyone laughed at me when I shut that business down, but I could not ignore the wake-up call. I was volunteering on a project to get locally grown food into a school. That project was a complete failure, and I discovered that there were few local farmers. There's only 4 days' worth of food in the grocery stores, and everything comes 1,500 miles via a just-in-time trucking system. I lost friends and family who told me I was crazy to worry about that, but I kept at it. I'm Marjorie Wildcraft. Those of us who know what's going on in the world know you need to become self-reliant before the dollar collapses. I've created a free webinar at gcnfood.com. I can show you, like I've shown hundreds of thousands of people, how to grow lots of food, even if you have no experience, you're older, or you're out of shape. Do it now, before the stores are boarded up and food is not available at any price. Go to gcnfood.com. gcnfood.com.